The meeting to order. Today is Wednesday, February 12th. The time is 3:31 p.m. Committee members present today, Vice Chair Senator Dyson, Senator McGuire, Senator French, and myself, Senator Giesel. I'm pretty confident that Senator Fairclough, Bishop, and Machiki will be joining us shortly. Today, our recording secretary is Ann Kreichelberg. Thank you, Ann. And Shane Rudd is on the LIO teleconference, and he'll be playing a big role because one of our testifiers is calling in today. And Lindsay Williams, my staff, is here as well. So we're going to start out. Welcome, Senator Bishop. Let the record reflect that Senator Bishop has joined us. So first item on the agenda today, we're going to start out with Senate Bill 138. And we have invited testimony today coming from companies. We'll start out with TransCanada, followed by ConocoPhillips Alaska, ExxonMobil, BP Exploration Alaska, and AGDC will be online and available for questions. So, great. We'll go ahead and start out. Let me see. I'm just reading the rest of this. Okay, none of that matters. All right. So, lots of script. You know, some of it isn't relevant. Testifying first, we have Tony Palmer, who is Vice President, Major Products Development, TransCanada Pipeline. Welcome, Mr. Palmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Tony Palmer, Vice President, Major Projects Development for TransCanada, and thank you for this opportunity. My comments today with regards to the bill will be brief, and I'd be pleased to take comments now or after you've received testimony from all the parties. Firstly, TransCanada is supportive of the legislation with regards to the taxation of natural gas, but of course that's not our primary interest. That's primarily between the state of Alaska and the three producers. In our view, the bill is intended to establish a legislative framework to implement the principles set out in the HOA and MOU, and that's clearly what our interests are. We note the following supportive elements of the bill. It expands the mandate of AGDC to enable it through an appropriate subsidiary to participate as an equity holder in the liquefaction component of the Alaska LNG project and potentially in the midstream component if the state elects to exercise its equity option on the TransCanada component of the project. Secondly, it establishes a large diameter natural gas pipeline project fund and the appropriations for which would be used to fund the planning, financing, acquisition, maintenance, construction, operation of the project by the state. It also authorizes the Commissioner of Natural Resources to participate in the negotiation of certain contracts relating to the projects and such contracts to be brought back to the legislature for approval. It also authorizes the Commissioner of Natural Resources to enter into certain short-term contracts relating to certain project services contemplated in the project. And we understand that this provision is intended to cover, for example, a precedent agreement that's referred to in the MOU. It's important to understand that there are lots of stages here in this process. That is what's contemplated, and it's important that these stages remained processed appropriately by the legislature and by all parties. And finally, TransCanada will continue to work with the administration to ensure that we are aligned on the bill. And that completes my comments, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Palmer? Yes, Senator Bishop.
Mr. Palmer, thank you for coming before the committee today. If you could maybe summarize, what do you think is the best value that you bring to the project for the state of Alaska?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, I think there's a number of values that TransCanada brings to the table. Let me try to walk through them probably in three components. Firstly, it's TransCanada's credentials and our experience and expertise. This project contemplates constructing a $10 billion approximately pipeline across Alaska. in summer and winter conditions across a significant mountain range. TransCanada has worked on this project now for some 40 years, so in addition to our experience and expertise elsewhere in North America, we bring tremendous knowledge of this particular project. We own some 40,000 miles of big-inch natural gas pipeline across North America, 10,000 in the United States and 30,000 in Canada. We've been in business and completing projects of this nature for some 60 years. We actually have done this prior in previous projects. We built the first three gas pipelines across the Andes in South America. We've had a pipeline across the Rockies in Canada on the way to California for 50 years. We expanded that project in the early 1990s. And we are constructing pipelines in Mexico today. They're in similar mountainous terrain. So that's the first really component would be our credentials, our experience and expertise. Secondly, I would go to the things that we bring directly, the assets we bring directly to this project today. And I would say that those are the assets that were developed under the Alaska Pipeline Project, the AGEA structure, the assets that were developed by that group of companies, TransCanada and ExxonMobil, will be contributed if this project, as contemplated under the MOU and HOA, is sanctioned by the legislature. Those assets will be contributed and available to the state as we go forward, available for this project. They are significant. There's a significant amount of work that went into that. And secondly, as part of that, you have the issue of timing. This MOU and HOA that's in front of you has taken almost a year of development and negotiation amongst the six parties to negotiate. Those things are in order to complete that complex negotiation, that's not something that was started in the middle of December and completed in the middle of January. It was completed over the course of a year. So we have a timing advantage in this group of companies and the state. We have aligned under this structure. And thirdly, I believe that this is a smooth and amicable transition out of the AGEA structure and into the new contemplated structure that both the state administration as well as TransCanada are willing to work with. And if this is sanctioned by the legislature, that will move forward quickly this summer.
Thank you. Further questions, Senator Bishop? Okay. Any other questions from committee members for Mr. Palmer?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Palmer. Oh, pardon me. Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome. Mr. Palmer, whether it's appropriate or not, there are Alaskans who have questions about your involvement in the project. So I would just first say to those who might value my opinion on it, your company is outstanding. Your history is very good in this line of work, and you have 40,000 miles of pipe in North America, which speaks volumes for what you've done for your shareholders. Can you talk to Alaskans or this committee about it goes to Senator Bishop and the value question. So there was some work that was done in trying to move the AGEA process forward that may not be valuable to this project. And is there any way that we can find out inside of the investment that Alaskans feel like we've paid for already? And TransCanada shareholders certainly have paid sometimes up to 50% for that work, and at other times much less than that. But that you do have an investment that your shareholders want a return on. So is there any way that Alaskans can see inside of the money that we've invested how that breaks apart between AGEA that was advancing us into the North American market versus the additional work that's been done to create alignment here after the governor changed maybe our relationship?
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, an excellent question. Let me try to be responsive comprehensively to that. I would say that any of the work that was completed north of Livengood would clearly be applicable and valuable for this project. So the work that was completed under the Alaska Pipeline Project on the gas treatment plant would be applicable. The work on the pipeline routing down to Livengood would clearly be applicable, because that's where the gas pipeline would now be redirected towards the west, towards Nikiski, as opposed to coming south east towards Canada. But in addition to that, of course, some of the overall analysis that were completed on pipeline integrity, pipeline strength, all of that design work, which is really representative of the entire project, is clearly valuable for the entire project, not solely for the miles, the mileage south of Livengood, southeast of Livengood. So it's very challenging to put a direct dollar percentage. I know that in the past we've tried to assess the total dollars that are valuable for this project, transferable. Some parties would say that that's 30 to 50% of the work that is directly applicable. But it's very challenging, Senator Faircloth, through the chair, to put a direct number to that. You're exactly right. The state, through its AGIA reimbursements, has invested in those dollars, as have TransCanada and ExxonMobil shareholders, because the reimbursement covered, as you described, a portion of the costs that were expended on the entire work. And I would say that it was the change in the overall gas market, primarily, that caused the structure to not see a pipeline built. When I testified in front of this committee, as well as other committees, 6 years ago, shale gas production in North America was in the order of 3 to 5 billion cubic feet a day. Today, it's 25 billion cubic feet a day. By the way, that's about 5 Alaska pipeline projects that were contemplated. And parties contemplate that that will go to 50 or 60 BCF a day. So we've truly seen a revolution in the North American gas business to the benefit of consumers. Now, it has not been to the benefit of producers and the benefit of producing states. But North America produces something in the order of 80 BCF a day of production. And gas prices today, if you went back to forecasts 6 years ago, were contemplated to be $6 to $8. Well, unfortunately, they're more like $3 to $4. Not this week, this cold week, but generically they've been about $3 to $4. That's a difference, something in the order of $4 per MCF. That's about $300 million a day being transferred from what folks thought would be coming to producers and producing states to what's going to consumers. Very beneficial to North American consumers. On the other hand, that's made it very challenging to build a pipeline from Alaska down to the lower 48.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer. Next, we have Pat Flood, who is the supervisor for Alaska North Slope Gas, ConocoPhillips. Welcome, Mr. Flood.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Pat Flood. I supervise the North Slope Gas Development Team for ConocoPhillips and Anchorage. ConocoPhillips appreciates the opportunity to testify today in support of SB 138. Last week, I came before you to discuss the heads of agreement and said that ConocoPhillips believes that there are four key areas where it is important to get legislative input to continue advancing the project as envisioned in the heads of agreement. What I told you was that the state must decide that it wants to participate in the project. The state needs to decide what share of gas the state would have, which would set the state participation share. The legislature needs to define a production tax taken as gas molecules, which, with the existing state royalty, also taken as gas molecules, would provide the state's overall gas share that would support the state participation share. And as I said before, this state gas share would need to be consistent with and support the state participation share. Also, the legislature needs to give the administration the necessary tools to confidentially work through the various agreements and contracts required to move the project ahead as outlined in the heads of agreement. We think that overall the proposed legislation as general law effectively addresses these three key areas. In their sectional analysis this past Friday, the administration broke the proposed legislation into three groups of sections. And I will, the first group dealt with AGDC's scope, powers, and structure. And the second dealt with the DNR commissioner's powers and duties with respect to contract negotiations and the oil and gas leases. And the third group dealt with the tax statutes. And so today I will address the comments in that same three groups. So as I said, the first group addresses AGDC and its potential role with regards to an LNG project. ConocoPhillips supports AGDC managing the state's participation share in an LNG project. We realize that there are ongoing legislative discussions about the structure being proposed. And ultimately, the details of AGDC's structure and authority are decisions for the state. We simply support AGDC as a viable way for the state to participate in an LNG project. The second group of sections in Title 38 relate to the DNR Commissioner's flexibility with respect to negotiating changes to the oil and gas leases from which the gas that would be committed to a larger project could come, and for the myriad other agreements that would be required in order to progress an LNG project and manage the state's role in such a project. The LNG business, as your consultants have told you, requires numerous contracts covering nearly all aspects of the value chain. So for the state to effectively participate in a large natural gas project, such as an LNG project, with other private co-venturers, the commissioners of both DNR and DOR need to be able to negotiate confidentially the details of these many agreements in a way that doesn't compromise commercial positions. We believe that the commissioners need this authority in order for the state to effectively participate in a project with other parties. The final set of sections deals with the tax statutes in Title 43. These provisions set a fixed gross value production tax at 10.5%. with the ability of the state to accept payment of this tax in gas molecules. Effectively, the choice of the tax rate, when combined with the existing royalty percentage, would set the state gas share for participation in a natural gas project, such as the LNG project that we contemplated in the heads of agreement. ConocoPhillips does support the provisions that allow for a fixed gross production tax payable in gas. The 10.5% rate the administration has proposed yields a combined royalty plus production tax in the range of the 20 to 25% that's contemplated in the heads of agreement. Overall, Madam Chair, ConocoPhillips supports the legislation, recognizing that it contains some significant policy decisions the legislature needs to make when contemplating the state's role in a large natural gas project, including the LNG project contemplated in the heads of agreement. To the extent that we can help you by providing information or perspectives on those issues, we're happy to do so. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and we're available to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Flood. Questions for Mr. Flood? Yes, Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Flood. Great presentation there. And will those be read? Those are read into the record. So, are there a copy of your comments that are be available for the committee?
I'm sure that could be made available.
Thank you. I'd like. It would be fine if you could do that for me. Follow up, Madam Chairman.
Sure, absolutely.
You mentioned a myriad of other agreements. Do you have a ballpark? What on the definition of myriad of other agreements?
So, for example, what type of other agreements, Senator Bishop, through the chair?
Are we looking at a dozen or 25 other agreements or six more agreements that needed to be signed? You'd made reference to a myriad of other agreements, so I'm just curious.
Senator Bishop, through the chair, I honestly couldn't give you any kind of really great head count about those. The types of agreements, for example, that I can think of are potentially a gas marketing agreement or an LNG marketing agreement that we talked about that might be contemplated between any one of the producers and the administration, any of the project agreements that would be required. So there's a number of different agreements, but I can't give you any set answer.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Any other questions for Mr. Flood?
Just to follow up on that.
Yes, Senator French.
I thought it was a good question because I kind of had the same reaction. It's like, how broad is this? But you mentioned a gas marketing agreement, project agreement. Do you see a fiscal stability contract as being one of those?
Senator French, through the chair, we have said for many years now that durability of fiscal terms is going to be a very important and vital part of this project. And so that is something that we contemplate requiring. What the terms of that might be, we haven't discussed, but we do anticipate that would be part of the discussion that would be going forward, and that whatever that might be would be coming back to the legislature for ratification in 2015.
Thank you. Further questions? Yes, Senator McGuire.
Thank you, through the chair, Mr. Flood. You mentioned that ConocoPhillips supports AGDC's management of the state share, equity share, but that your company didn't take a personal position about how that was done, that you said that was a legislative decision. And I just wanted to ask you a couple more details about that so that we can get our arms around that, because I think that will be a point of discussion. I know that it's a subsidiary, so I'd like to know if it's important to ConocoPhillips that it's a subsidiary of AGDC as opposed to the corporation itself. That's one. Two, in the sections 1-7, there are some fairly specific requirements with respect to how that subsidiary will be managed, and the idea that it'll only be a portion of the board and that the finances will be kept separate. I want to know if that's important to you, number two. And then finally, number three, just to share with the committee a broader view of how the producers, I guess you as one of the three producers, might view some of the opportunities and yet concerns in working with AGDC, which was empowered through House Bill 4 with some fairly specific direction from the legislature, and that they're also going to be told through this bill to keep working on a Plan B, which at some point or another could possibly compete. So just questions there.
Senator McGuire, through the chair, if I may take those in order. In the first instance, I think it's the key thing from ConocoPhillips' perspective is that the state participate in the project. That's the important thing for us. They, of course, need to participate in a way that's consistent with a very large project of this magnitude that's going to be difficult to do, but the most important thing is that they participate. How and with who the state participates is really, we think, a matter almost entirely for the state, although, as you point out, we would have an interest. So in regards to the first part of your question as to the structure that AGDC has, I don't have a specific response to that. We don't have any objections to what is in the specific objections to what's in the current legislation. And we think that is primarily an issue for the state as to whether that works out for them. In regards to AGDC's role in HB4, through HB4, in for example, I believe you're discussing the ASAP project. ConocoPhillips has no comment with regard to whether that's an issue or not. We support AGDC. We recognize that they have an obligation and are also advancing the ASAP project, but that does not lead us to object to AGDC participation in this project.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Fairclough.
Madam Chairman, we have, as everyone knows, three different pieces of moving pieces, the HOA, the MOU, and the taxing bill. And so specifically with what we're talking about the agreement on the HOA. You know, if we were to take each one of those pieces independently, the HOA is actually establishing the agreement on page 10 of the Heads of Agreement, 5.3, I believe, where it says the state would participate in Alaska LNG project at a participating interest share in the Alaska LNG project components consistent with the state's gas share in these components. Is that accurate, Mr. Flood?
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, yes, that's accurate.
And so I just wanted to outline that we're working with all of these variables as we talk, and if we don't actually get through one of the variables and agree, it's sort of hard to keep throwing out other pieces in the other components. So when we're talking about that particular variable, we have people that have come together, and they have reasons, and the heads of agreement actually lay out the reasons why the state participation the state's participation in the project is beneficial. And I just would be interested, certainly we don't need to go into dialogue here, but if we have a problem that we don't want to do that, it would be good to know that. Because for me, at this point, with three different individual pieces that we need to review, it seems like we need to be in it together for Alaskans. We need to join hands together, however you want to do it, put the shoulder to the wheel and say, if we don't like it, what do we want to change about it? Because this is an opportunity in time where we have signed agreements with people ready to go forward. And so instead of just pointing out the problems, I hope that we can find ways to offer a solution, because Alaskans depend on it. If we're going to take a particular piece out of the heads of agreement and think that that's related to the actual gas structure, it's different. I just really think, Madam Chairman, that we need to resolve at some point, and I guess we can do it together, but it's disjointed for the public that's watching if we don't resolve whether it's a really big deal that parties have come together and signed to benefit Alaska. And it is a balance in Alaska's interest whether we believe that equity share should be dollar for dollar linked or not. I think that's where the conversation is going now. And for me, I understand the benefits, so I would take you to page 9, again, of the HOA for anyone following at home, 5.1. And again, it's talking about the state's participation in the project. And under A, it says we are trying to basically protect the state's mineral interest and maximize the value of Alaska's interests. We are trying to improve alignment between the state and our producers. We are trying to create transparency for the administration so that we can act in a proprietary manner. We are trying to make sure that access and pro-expansion principles are available to those that want to produce LNG, and we are creating an opportunity to deliver gas to Alaskans and an opportunity for additional state revenues. For me, those are things I agree with, and so if there's something else that isn't there that we should agree, I guess I would ask Alaskans to let us know what else should have been negotiated or what they see missing, because to me, the heads of agreement is fairly solid, but it does sort of rock right on the issue of, do we believe that the state should have an equal interest? It comes down to the HOA is guiding Alaska's share of equity equal to what we're investing. That's layman's term. I am not a gas and oil specialist. I am not an attorney. But to me, that's the issue. And, boy, I just hope that we understand that really well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Fairclough. Further questions? Any additional comments, Mr. Flood?
No, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we have Bill McMahon. He is Alaska Gas Development, ExxonMobil Production Company.
Madam Chair, members of the Senate Resources Committee, for the record, my name is Bill McMahon. I'm a senior commercial advisor, and my bio is a little bit out of date. I did transfer to our development company on Monday, so I still have to get some more business cards. So I've got 31 years of experience with ExxonMobil and first started pursuing Alaska gas commercialization back in 1992. From the outset, let me say that ExxonMobil supports Senate Bill 138, and we appreciate Governor Parnell and his administration's hard work in this matter, and we appreciate them for introducing legislation that's consistent with the heads of agreement that we executed in January. ExxonMobil's committed to pursue commercialization of Alaska natural gas, and ExxonMobil's committed to being part of the Alaska Natural Gas Project. The heads of agreement and SB 138 are critical steps towards successfully bringing the natural gas resources of Alaska's North Slope to market through this project. It makes a significant step towards allowing the state, the producers, AGDC, and TransCanada to work together to progress the project and to establish a process to develop the fiscal and project framework that's essential for advancing this project to completion. If legislation such as Senate Bill 138 that's consistent with an HOA is enacted, ExxonMobil will be ready to move forward with pre-FEED work activities, a necessary and critical step, and a step that has never been taken before. And this will help us achieve Alaska North Slope gas commercialization. I won't repeat the things that my cohort Pat Flood have said, but you know, essentially there's three things that were contemplated by Senate Bill 138. That's state participation, a state percentage of the gas, as well as a process to negotiate project enabling agreements. And you know, that's the legislation in its essence. And you know, we're encouraged that the legislature is taking on Senate Bill 138 so early in the session. And you know, we look forward to working with the legislature as well as the administration as we bring this legislation to approval.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm available for questions.
All right. Questions for Mr. McMahon. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, through the chair. I think Senator Frickloff brings up a great point for the public and for all of us to think about, that we, some of us, myself included, will go back to the MOU, we'll go back to the heads of agreement to make certain points. But the notion, and I'm asking this question to you, if I might, Mr. McMahon, is that all of the relevant points, the key points that are referenced in the heads of agreement, as well as the MOU, are contained with a statutory reference somewhere in there in Senate Bill 138. In other words, anything that is that requires legislative permission or authority to enact the notions that are contained in the heads of agreement and the memorandum of understanding are all right there in Senate Bill 138. Is that your understanding?
Senator McGuire, through the chair, that is my understanding, is that the Senate Bill 138 is consistent with the principles set out in the heads of agreement. Can't speak directly about the MOU. You know, that's a matter between the state and TransCanada, but certainly very consistent with the heads of agreement.
Very good. Follow-up, Senator McGuire?
Yes, and so if I might, I think what's helpful then on testimony when we're on the bill right now would be not just places that you support, but if there are places as we move along where you have concern that the legislature, as Senator Fairclough just indicated, might be moving a part or piece that's actually, to use an old phrase, a must-have, a requirement in order to make this heads of agreement come together. And certainly I would submit, you know, that's also, it's also referenced on page 12 in terms of Article 7 of the Heads of Agreement, 7.1. It says, if I might
yes,
read,
please.
Alignment among parties is critical to the success of a project of the scope and magnitude necessary to develop Alaska gas resources, general legislation to allow state participation and gas share in any such project is critical for the progression and implementation of a project. So you see it reflected there as well, but I think as we move toward getting this bill out and on to the next, that's probably right, that we need to narrow down sort of where are the places where someone might want to amend Senate Bill 138, which is where our powers come in, and how might that then affect the heads of agreement? And in the case of TransCanada and the state, then how would that affect the MOU? Right?
Yes.
So that was rhetorical.
All right. Very
sorry.
Good. All right. Senator French, your question.
I have a non-rhetorical question. And it was really brought on by the provocative and excellent remarks of both of my colleagues on the committee, but I guess I want to bring it down to a case that we've discussed in private, and I've also discussed in a letter to the governor last week, and it's a hard question that's embedded in this, and I may as well get it out in the open, because that's what we do in committee. We get to ask questions. Do you think it's possible to come to an agreement to modify this bill with respect to the other two moving parts, the heads of agreement, mainly in the MOU, much less so, by excluding from the future contracts that will negotiate any linkage to oil taxes? Would it be possible to for us to come to build a pipeline together as partners without having embedded oil taxes in that contract and do it just through the royalty in kind on our gas and the royalty the taxes gas with respect to our production taxes? That's a hard question, but it came up, and so I thank you, Senator McGuire, for provoking me, and I'm sorry it's you sitting here, but just we may as well start having the conversation.
Senator French, through the chair, I appreciate hard questions. I mean, we all face a tremendous challenge with this project. You know, what we're faced with is how do we put together project-enabling contracts that are going to be sufficient to allow investors to put up the capital for this project, to allow investors to have the assurance that they're going to get the returns expected from an investment like this, to have the assurances so that lenders will have the assurances that they can loan money to this project with the confidence they're going to be repaid, and then most importantly, that the buyers of LNG will be able to sign long-term contracts that they can count on Alaska resources to fuel their economy for decades to come. And the challenge that the Alaska LNG parties have, the legislature as well as the administration has, is how can we develop those project-enabling contracts in a fashion that support those four needs? And so, you know, at this point, I can't answer the question about stability on oil taxes and how that may play into this. And that's why I like what we're doing here with Senate Bill 138, is we're setting out a process so that we can go through this together to find the solutions. What is it going to take to allow this project to move forward? And so keep those tough questions coming, because we're all together going to have to solve those.
Thank you.
Further questions for Mr. McMahon? Bishop.
Well, since we started the tough questions, I'll follow up with a little analogy, so let's just get it out here on the table. And the two ladies were eloquent, and Senator French was also equally as eloquent, and I just break it down into the pipeliner terms. And this gets back to the people of Alaska, because this is a big deal. And when they write the history books, we all want to make sure we're on the right side of history when they write it, not only us here at the table, but I believe the producers and the pipeline builders as well. So, and we got to build that trust and comfort level. And where I'm coming from right now, I love to play poker. And I think as the producers, there's three excellent poker players, professional poker players. And I'm kind of the novice in the room. So at the end of the day, I don't want to be left owing you guys a bunch of IOUs. So help us build that trust to the people of Alaska going forward. Thank you.
Very good. Further comments or questions? Thank you, Mr. McMahon.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Next we have Dave Van Tool, Regional Manager, BP Exploration Alaska. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Van Tile, and I'm regional manager with BP here in Alaska. And I just wanted to thank you for the opportunity to offer some brief comments today on Senate Bill 138. Well, as we've testified before, BP believes that the heads of agreement among the parties that you have testifying before you today, AGDC, DNR, and DOR, all seven parties, is critical to successfully advancing the Alaska LNG project. Therefore, the key question for examining SB 138 is simple. Is SB 138 faithful to the heads of agreement? For BP, the answer to that question is yes. SB 138 moves all the parties forward together as envisioned in the HOA. So BP supports Senate Bill 138. Again, we'll look at the three P's that were referenced by my colleague, Mr. McMahon. One is participation. Senate Bill 138 provides for state participation through AGDC and authorizes the state to negotiate contracts consistent with the terms of the HOA. The second P is percentage, and the bill provides a percentage for tax as gas that, when added to the state's royalty in kind share, puts the state at the table with a participation in the range of 20 to 25%, again, consistent with the terms of the HOA. And third is process. The bill lays out a process for negotiations to occur, and it provides transparency to the legislature by access as outlined in Senate Bill 138. And BP believes that's the winning way, that we really need to do this together. Now, there's a couple of areas, Senator McGuire, you referenced, of particular interest to BP in the way the bill has been drafted. One area of interest is ensuring that the newly formed subsidiary of AGDC is established in an efficient manner. Now, BP has formed subsidiaries in the past, and we know about the due diligence required by tax and finance professionals and whatnot in getting those set up, and it's well worth the effort spent. But we also want to ensure that the new subsidiary is established in a timely manner so that pre-FEED can start ramping up once the bill is enacted. And that includes, this efficiency includes, the appropriate sharing of staff between the new subsidiary and the AGDC parent. Also, in the bill, there's various administrative determinations that are required. And BP believes these determinations should be made consistent with the HOA, and the bill could be perhaps clearer in that regard. Ensuring that those determinations are made consistent with the HOA will reduce uncertainty for all the parties. It'll avoid unintended consequences. And it will enable a timely and efficient ramp-up of pre-FEED activities. So while certain technical corrections to the bill may be inevitable, we don't see the need for any substantive changes to the bill. So, Madam Chair, with that, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to comment and certainly look forward to continuing to work with the committee on SB 138. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Van Tile. Senator Faircliff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Van Tile.
Thank you.
Can you tell me, in looking at the AGD structure, if there is anything structurally inconsistent with the determinations in the HOA versus a subsidiary being created?
Senator Faircliff, through the chair, I don't know that there's anything inconsistent, because the HOA, in my recollection of the HOA, it's fairly broad, high-level principles and whatnot in the formation or in the involvement of the state through AGDC. But as you've heard the phrase, the devil is in the details. And that's why I referenced in my comments the necessary due diligence. We don't see a problem, but we do see an opportunity, I guess, with the skilled staff that AGDC currently has, being able to appropriately work on the efforts where their skills are best used. There's ways that you can do that through subsidiaries, and we think that might be an opportunity. That's all.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions? Senator Machicki.
I have one. Mr. Van Tile, through the chair. So all of you are consistent that you feel that state participation is key. Mm-hmm. None of you seem to, other than perhaps TransCanada, none of you seem to care a whole lot who it is we go through for that participation or if we have a partner. Okay. Just tell me the most important reasons for you that the state participates. It's an unusual agreement, okay? So you got some type of risk reduction, project alignment, cost reduction, stable tax regime, a lot of choices. But I'd like to know your primary reason for participation, which, again, is unusual in this kind of agreement.
Senator Machicki, through the chair, I guess a couple of comments. One is on big mega projects, big LNG mega projects around the world, it's not that uncommon for the host government to have a role. The nature of the role varies with the nature of the specific regime in which the LNG project finds itself. But it's common for the host government to have a pretty vested interest just because of the magnitude of the project. The reason that another comment is we do care about who the state chooses to partner with. On the one hand, the HOA sets out the key tenet of state participation. So the manner of the state's participation is really what's dealt with in the MOU. The HOA says state participation is important. We want to make sure that whoever came into our joint venture had the requisite financial strength, technical capabilities and whatnot, which TransCanada does, but that's really the state's choice and as exercised in the MOU. The reason that we feel state participation is so critical is, I guess in a nutshell, nothing aligns like equity. If we all have the same sort of equity investment in the project, we all have the same commercial interest in seeing problems get solved in the right way, we'll tend to agree more. And when you're investing, when BP is investing our share of $65 billion, agreeing among our co-ventures is pretty important because we want the project to run efficiently. So state participation provides for that sort of alignment, really like no other lever that we can think of. And that's really why it's so important to BP.
Follow-up, Senator Machicki?
So just to clarify, what you're saying is nothing creates alignment like each party having cash in the game. Not everyone understands the application of equity that may be watching, so.
I apologize, Senator Machicki, through the chair. Yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Further questions? For Mr. Van Tile. Senator French.
May as well ask Mr. Van Tile as well. On the subject of oil taxes, the HOA agreement, Article 8, talks about royalty and production taxes, gas taxes. It doesn't mention any oil taxes. There is some mention in the next article about maintaining a healthy long-term oil business. That's in Article 10. But there's no discussion about making oil taxes part of the negotiations of a contract that would spring to life were we to pass this enabling legislation. Do you see oil taxes as being part of that conversation?
Senator French, through the chair, I guess I'd start my response to that question with just the statement that BP believes that this body took an important step last year in establishing that healthy oil regime, the oil industry, oil business that you reference, by passing SB 21. We've seen shortly after its passage the announcement of new activity on the slope. BP is bringing on a couple of more rigs in 2015 and 2016 at Prudhoe Bay. We've seen other projects move forward. That's the kind of healthy oil business that really is important for building this huge gas project on top of, because it will help dispersing some of the costs that it takes to operate the North Slope. As far as what specific elements will be in the contract that comes back to the legislature in 2015, again, as I mentioned, it's important that this whole process, including the terms of that contract, work for everybody. You know, BP could draft up a contract that works for us. If it doesn't work for the other entities that sign the HOA, the legislature, the people of Alaska, that's not going to get us very far. We want to find a solution that works for all of those participants in the HOA, for this body, and for Alaskans. We're talking about embarking on a multi-decade project that has to be robust and has to pass the bulletin board test. That's why we look forward to engaging in that process that, under the SB 138, can involve the legislature as we work through those issues.
Thank you.
Further questions for Mr. Van Tuyl? Senator Bishop.
Yes. The equity cash position that you described a little bit earlier, and I don't know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask it. It's one of my questions, and I just haven't been able to get deep enough into it yet. Is there anything in this agreement that you've seen so far that would preclude any more equity coming into the game, an equity partner, either with BP or Conoco or Exxon or even the state's position? Would if there was somebody coming in with a sizable chunk of equity, could that deal still be struck with inside the framework of this agreement?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, the short answer to that question is no. There's no specific provision that would preclude bringing in another party, and those sorts of provisions are very common in commercial agreements where transfers are authorized. Usually there are within a framework, again, to make sure that the party that you're bringing in is creditworthy, is technically capable, and whatnot. But it's typical that those sorts of things are allowed because they happen on big projects, and you see that pretty commonly as mega projects evolve.
But
go ahead, follow up, Senator Bishop.
So did I hear you say that this bill would preclude somebody bringing cash in, or would or it wouldn't? Yes or no? Could I bring? I got $10 billion. I want to partner up with you. Could we do a deal?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, the bill envisions a process that would result in an actual agreement. Mm-hmm. There's nothing in the bill that would preclude another party coming in and participating.
Okay. The reason for the question was earlier in one of our presentations, we saw the Gregorian project had two initial partners. Into the project, there were four more partners. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's my point.
Senator Bishop, through the chair, that's a pretty common evolution of mega projects, particularly mega LNG projects.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Fairclough.
Thank you. And just to follow up on that particular question, would that be an agreement then or a process that would be developed at the next stage of the game so that if equity interest were available for sale? I mean, 100% is 100%, so if someone brings $10 billion per se to the table, they have to be able to buy someone else's interest. Is that correct? Please.
Sorry. Senator Fairclough, through the chair, I apologize for cutting you off. Those sorts of terms will be included in the actual joint venture agreements that will be worked with the state at the table through the pre-feed process and then on through the feed process. Those agreements get quite detailed, quite comprehensive, to cover a whole host of issues, and I assure you that one of them will be transfers.
Good follow-up, Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so if this isn't really to our speaker, but then if we wanted to have impact on that, we would we've attached things before to pieces of legislation as far as legislative intent goes, or I can't remember what we did on the last bill, but we make recommendations on what we want considered. So if there was a particular criteria that we wanted entered into about that percentage, then we could ask the administration to negotiate that in the next piece that we might see prior to reaching final decision. I mean, if you'd like to comment, we can ask that to the administration.
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, is the question whether or not this committee could add a statement of intent to the bill? If it is, I'm not exactly sure on the rules of legislative drafting and whatnot. I believe that you can, but and if you wanted to provide direction in the manner in which the state should be exercising its equity participation in the project to provide the administration direction, that would be a way.
Madam Chairman, I just was trying to reach a way for the legislature to guide the process in future agreements that are going to be negotiated if we're successful in confidentiality without every 60 people in the room trying to negotiate. And so if that were to happen and we're interested in the joint venture agreement and how that might roll out, then we might give the administration specifics on what we think is valuable inside that trade so that we can measure again at the next time that something would be before the legislature to come through the next gate, that we would know whether they were able to accomplish that on our behalf.
Mm-hmm. Sure, something certainly to discuss with the administration. Anything further from Mr. Ventile? Yes, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I'm not stupid, but I'm slow. And Senator French said something here that perked my interest. And I, not putting words in his mouth, but what I thought he was getting at, that there was something in these three documents that locked in oil prices and for the future. And I always doubt myself, and I hadn't seen that. And, back to what Senator Fairclough is saying, that I would certainly, at some point in our process, be a very amendable for us saying it is our intent and clear understanding that there's nothing in these agreements that lock in oil prices and so on. And so, but anyways, I thank Senator French for kind of bringing that to my attention, and I ran out here to talk to some people from the administration to see if that was their understanding. But anyways, valuable conversation.
Senator Dyson, through the chair, I think it's important, given antitrust law and whatnot, that I clarify for the record that I believe you're referring to oil taxes and yep. not locking in oil prices.
I'm sorry. Yes. Thank you. Good catch. Yeah. Thank you.
Further questions for Mr. Ventile?
I have.
Yes, Senator Michiki.
Thank you, Madam Chair, through the chair. So, okay, unusual question. What folks in Alaska fear, we have leadership from some of the top corporations in the world sitting across from folks from everyday walks of life that are Alaskans serving in this body. And what they fear is that we walk away from this agreement and you're all rubbing your hands together, feeling really good about, to be frank, what you pulled over on the people of Alaska. I personally value all that has been created for jobs and wealth and what has funded our state for the last 40 years by corporations' presence like yours in this state. But what I ask you, and I know that I'm fairly sure that you know these three agreements, but particularly Senate Bill 138, as well as anyone. What is the value for the state in Senate Bill 138? Just in your words, I mean, I know you understand the value for the producers, and I have a pretty good idea of the value for TransCanada. What do you think is the value for the state in your eyes, through your eyes?
Senator Michiki, through the chair, I think there's a number of very important elements of value for the state enabled by Senate Bill 138. One is this is the best opportunity to commercialize Alaska's North Slope gas, full stop. That's certainly BP's interest in advancing this Alaska LNG project, and we certainly think that's a shared interest, that the state wants to do so as well. And again, that's another element of alignment around the project. We all see that the same, and so we'll be pulling in the same direction. That'll bring in a new source of revenue to the state, and it'll be a long-term source of revenue because that's the way LNG projects are. We'll see a long project plateau generating cash for decades. That's one. Another and one aspect of the HOA that I'm particularly pleased with is the inclusion of AGDC. The Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation was tasked by this body with a singular focus of getting gas to Alaskans. We recognize that that's an important, a critical element for a successful project. So AGDC's involvement ensures that that's something that's going to be looked at. And that's an important element for many, many Alaskans of having a reliable source of gas supply in state. There's also the opportunity for new jobs, not only during the construction period. Those will be massive jobs. It'll be hiring all kinds of able-bodied folks. We'll be looking at training, and the HOA talks about cooperation with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development in developing training programs, because we want to have available qualified Alaskans to work on the project. But also long-term, once the construction period is over, we'll have two new major operating facilities in Alaska, the gas treatment plant up on the North Slope and the liquefaction plant down at Nikiski, that'll be hiring full-time folks for decades to come. So I think for Alaskans, there's a lot of benefit associated with SB 138. And it's certainly not BP's intent to enter into an agreement where one of the parties, just for your opening comment, feels like it wasn't a square deal, because that's not the bedrock of a long-term commercial agreement, which is really what we want. We want this relationship to be robust for decades. And that's what we think the HOA and now Senate Bill 138 that was based on the HOA provides for.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up, Senator Machicki.
Just a quick one. And in my experience, the best negotiation is when both sides walk out of the room equally unhappy.
Correct.
Right? Just to follow up, just again, you help negotiate parts of this contract, I assume, and we're also active with the administration in Senate Bill 138. As this thing morphs through the years, if it morphs through the years, depending on what commercial arrangements come about, how market changes develop, just what would be a pitfall that you would suggest we look out for as the legislation develops, if it changes through this session? And I guess what I'm trying to see is, if we have true alignment on a deal that works for everyone, then you would have some of those pitfalls in mind. Can you just give us an example of something that we would look out for? We all have lots. We have a long list of our own to look out for, but I'd like to know what you would see as sort of being a major flaw.
Senator Machicki, through the chair. I guess for the record, yes, I was involved in the development of the HOA, and no, I was not involved in the development of SB 138. I saw it the same time everyone else did when it was published, but clearly it was influenced by the heads of agreement. As far as pitfalls in developing this project and in all the agreements that will be matured through the years as we advance through pre-FEED and FEED, one thing that I guess springs to mind is not to foreclose options. A lot of times we look in the near term and we see something in front of us and we draw a conclusion to say we're not going to do that or we have to do this, and then the passage of time tells us that maybe that was hasty to preclude that option. So in developing long-term agreements, that's one of the bits of genius about the HOA, is that it's high-level principles that everyone can stand behind, and it allows the details to develop through time. And I think that's going to be an important aspect going forward.
Good. Further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, Mr. Van Tuyl.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So lastly, Dan Fauske, the president of AGDC, is online. I'm looking over. He is online, right? Okay. So, Mr. Fauske, can you hear us?
Yes, Madam Chair. Yes, Madam Chair, I can.
Great. So if you would offer your testimony.
Well, I don't, Madam Chair, I don't really have any testimony at this time. I called in basically for the ability to answer any questions if they came up.
Okay.
I appreciate the kind words that Mr. Van Tile and others had presented towards AGDC, and I don't want to waste the committee's time unless they have something of me that I'll let you move on with your business. So thank you.
Questions for Mr. Fauske. Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Fauske, can you talk to us about the nature of creating a subsidiary inside of AGDC and how that works either to the benefit or to the detriment of AGC, ADGC as a corporation, and really why? If we have AGDC, what are the reasons to create a new corporation inside of the existing one?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, if I heard your question correctly, is the benefit of creating a subsidiary. This bill, this subsidiary is unique in the fact that it is really a separate entity. It's not a subsidiary like you would normally see, in my opinion. It's a new board, a new structure, and we, the current management of AGDC, would have little if no involvement with the subsidiary the way it's structured. That's the question I believe is coming at me. Is if you ask me what the benefit is, I can't address the benefit other than I've created subsidiaries with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, the Northern Tobacco Securitization, the Alaska Capital Corp, the Corporation for Affordable Housing, and they've been successful entities. So there's a precedent that if done properly, they bring an extreme benefit because they can take on a specific piece of business, build a board around it that is structured towards that type of activity or professional expertise, and service and help the parent corporation in widening its business scope and the work that it needs to do. So I find an advantage to it. I don't want to disrupt, but this one's a little bit different in that I think there are people there that assume that this subsidiary would be just a natural transition into us, where in fact it isn't. We're not involved with this subsidiary if it's created under the current language in the bill.
Thank you, Senator Fairclough. Any other questions for Mr. Fauske? All right, seeing none at this time, Mr. Fauske, thank you for speaking with us, and I'm sure you're available for questions later. Thank you. All right, gentlemen, thank you very much for speaking with us, offering your testimony today, Mr. Palmer, Mr. Flood, Mr. McMahon, and Mr. Van Tile, as well as Mr. Fauske. At this time, we're going to switch gears a little bit. We're going to switch back to the Alaska North Slope royalty presentation by Black & Veatch. We stopped last time just as we were getting into royalty in kind and royalty in value. So we have online to take us through this section Deepa, Peter, and in the room, Jason. So I will let each of you introduce yourselves again for the record. And would you like to start, Jason, and then we'll go to the folks online.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Committee, thank you for having us here. We're happy to present the rest of an abbreviated part of our royalty study. For the record, I am Jason DeStichter with Black & Veatch, a senior consultant. I have been working on some version of marketing natural gas for the state of Alaska for the past 6 years. Started off with the AGEA project and all the various permutations that have happened as the markets have changed and the projects have changed. I am one of the main modelers for Black & Veatch. and have performed most of the analysis, or a big part of the analysis from a results part, and worked with Deepa and Peter and others within Black & Veatch. My background is in financial analysis, economic analysis, and I specialize in risk analysis for Black & Veatch. And I will now defer to Deepa and Peter.
All right. Deepa and Peter, welcome.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Madam Chair, this is Peter Apt. For the record, my name is Peter Apt. I'm Managing Director of Black & Veatch's Fuels Practice, responsible for our oil and gas fuels consulting business. I provided testimony to this committee on Monday in this hearing, specifically addressing the LNG markets and the supply chain elements of the royalty study that we have developed for the Department of Natural Resources in the state of Alaska. And I'm here to answer any further questions that may arise this evening. And I'll turn it over to Deepa, who will now continue.
Great. Welcome, Deepa. Deepa, are you there?
Hello.
Hello. Now we can hear you.
Okay, sorry. My line was being muted and unmuted several times.
Yes, I'm sure it was. So we concluded on slide 34, which was fiscal framework.
I am a principal with Black & Veatch and have been involved with assisting the state with the Alaska project, starting with SGDA through AGEA and now with the AKLNG project. I am an economist and an engineer by training, and I offer strategic analytical services and commercial support to our natural gas clients.
Welcome. I'll let you go ahead and start on page 34 and take us through the fiscal framework.
I will. Thank you, Madam Chairman. As we mentioned yesterday, you know, there's quite a significantly large body of work that the royalty study represented, and we're touching on the highlights here. I will reiterate again that we're happy to get into any details either here or you know, to answer any questions at a later date. The highlight of the fiscal section that I'm going to walk us through is just to help you understand the analysis that we did, looking at how Alaska compares as a large LNG project to the fiscal structures that other projects that have been successful have had, and whether we're competitive or not from that perspective, and also to look at some triggers that can help the state incentivize the Alaska LNG project, whether that be reductions in our fiscal take by reducing royalty or production tax or other alternate structures. So with that, let's stop on slide 36. And what it shows is that we looked at a number of projects worldwide, and the ones that are shown here in blue are other LNG projects that are either in operation or have achieved final investment decision and are under construction. And the headline here is that the fiscal take, the government take from these projects has a wide range, and it goes all the way from about 40% to close to 80 or 85% on a couple of projects. But overall, most of these projects, especially the large capital-intensive projects, will tend to see are on the lower end of the government take ratio. So with that, moving on to 37 and looking at under status quo, assuming SB21, what would the government take be from the Alaska LNG project? What our analysis shows is that without any changes to the fiscal structure and with the assumed capital cost for the project of $45 billion, the government take is somewhere between 70% and 80%, depending on whether you're looking at undiscounted total cash flows or from an NPV perspective. And this would be considered as being a fairly aggressive government take for a project that's as large and as complex as the Alaska LNG project. Now, one of the issues around that is that unlike a lot of the other projects, there's almost a fixed element here that's hard to move for us, which is the federal government take through the federal income tax of 35%. And so that's sort of a constraint that we have to work with, and one that we actively thought about, you know, in trying to see whether there's any way at all to try and reduce that leakage. Moving on to slide 38, and I apologize, there's a lot of information on this slide, and we probably should have simplified it a little. But the point we were trying to demonstrate here is we looked at some of the, you know, more straightforward and straightforward ways of the state incentivizing the Alaska LNG project. So we asked the question, well, can we get there by reducing our royalty rate? Can we get there by reducing our production tax rate? And just as in, just to bound that answer for us, we said, well, let's take away royalty completely. Let's take away production tax completely and see how much we're able to improve the attractiveness of this project. The bottom line for that analysis was that if we look at it, and there's various metrics here, but let's say we pick the return to the producers from this project, it's a little less than 15% under base case assumptions, base prices and the cap base reference case capital cost assumptions. Even if we completely gave away a royalty or if we reduced our production tax down to zero, that moves the return to the producers up by 1% in the case of royalty and up by about 1.5% from eliminating either property tax or production tax. And as I mentioned before, the constraint that we keep hitting up against is that any transfer of value that's designed in this way from the state towards the producers experiences a leakage because 35% of that value is then transferred to the federal government in the form of corporate income tax. And so, you know, that led us down the path of if there's a mechanism where if there's a way to incentivize the producers that the state can consider that would reduce the leakage to the federal government, then that's the way that the state as well as the producers can potentially win in respect to making this project more attractive.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator French has a question.
Just while we're on this somewhat bewildering slide, I just want to make sure that as I'm looking at the left-hand side, I see price sensitivity, and then and on the right-hand side, midstream CapEx sensitivity, and then four columns. And when you refer to on the fourth column in each of those, it refers to no production tax, I'm assuming you mean no gas production tax?
Senator French, through the chair, yes, you are right. I'm referring to no gas production tax.
Thank you.
And no royalty on gases, on gas as well.
Thank you.
Go ahead and continue, Deepa.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next question we looked at within the fiscal framework is looking at the state's choices with respect to its royalty share, mainly trying to understand what the value would be of going royalty in kind versus staying royalty in value for this project. Slide 39 lays out, you know, just some advantages and disadvantages relative to these two alternatives, and I know that this audience is quite familiar with them, but some of the highlights would be you know, royalty in kind can be attractive to the producers because it reduces valuation disputes and the commercial uncertainty for the project from the producer's perspective. It creates some disadvantages for the state because it requires marketing expertise, especially in the case of LNG, that we don't necessarily have. With royalty and value, from the state's perspective, there's familiarity with it from administering royalty and value historically at much greater volumes than we have with royalty in kind. The disadvantages would be a lack of transparency and not having access to for any third parties to the project. Slide 40 represents some analysis we did trying to quantify what the risk to the state would be from going royalty in kind. And there are, there are some elements that get included in royalty in value that may or may not be included in royalty in kind, such as whether GTP costs would be considered as a deduction, whether upstream field cost allowances would change, going between royalty in kind and royalty in value, and some of that is not clear yet. But the main risk that I would like to highlight here is that of price discounts. And on the chart on the right, you see the effect of that in the fourth bar. And the risk here is that due to the state's inexperience, if we stayed in royalty, if we went to royalty in kind and tried to market the gas or the LNG by ourselves, and we would be competing in that case, it should be noted also, with some of the best marketers in the world, namely the producers, Exxon, BP, and Costco, that we run a real risk of being disadvantaged in the deals that we could negotiate. And that could result in a discount on the price that we achieve in royalty in kind relative to the value we would have achieved just taking a percentage of the price that the producers are able to negotiate. And so the analysis that we ran showed that going to royalty in kind, we could lose as much as 75% of the value relative to royalty in value. Slide 41.
Deepa, would you pause for a second? Senator French just raised his hand.
Yeah, thank you. I have a question about the cost driver, the GTP costs, and how they would be treated differently under RIV versus RIK. I need you to walk me through why it would be different under each scenario.
Senator French, through the chair. I will try to do that. I will preface that by saying some of this is still unchartered and needs to be understood better what would happen, with more production on the slope as well as if the state went RIK. As it stands now, only Prudhoe Bay is currently allowed to deduct GTP costs for royalty calculation.
And if I could just jump in, if I could just jump in, could you just give me an idea of where that's captured? Is that embedded in our current tax code? Is it having to do with the operating agreement on the North Slope? I mean, why is it only Prudhoe Bay that's allowed to deduct GTP costs?
Senator French, through the chair, I'll attempt to answer that, and I will let Commissioner Bailash answer it as well. But I believe it's the royalty settlement agreement that captures that.
Commissioner Bailash, would you like to add?
For the record, Madam Chair, Joe Bailash, Commissioner of DNR, Deep is correct. There is a settlement agreement pertaining to gas at Prudhoe Bay and Prudhoe Bay only.
Thank you.
Thank you. Very good. Go ahead and proceed, Deepa.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So highlighting on slide 41, just the different risks that the state would face going royalty in kind, and this is something that we emphasized to the state as part of our study. The first one is that the state may need to build its own marketing organization, and we just talked about, it's a complex world when it comes to global LNG markets. There's a number of agreements that need to be done, and the marketing side as well is characterized by long-term relationships. It's not a transparent market with price discovery being readily achieved. And so there's a number of disadvantages that the state could be placed at if we were trying to do this on our own, given our current level of expertise. And as I mentioned, we would be competing with the producers who have well-established marketing experience as well as global portfolios. Being counterparty to the various agreements that we would be counterparty to will place counterparty risk on us as well. We would be open to default by any of our counterparties and the consequences of those.
Madam Chair, just on that point?
Taking our gas in kind would also cause us to need to make firm capacity commitments along the LNG supply chain, which could be a significant amount of money as well.
Deepa?
And one other risk that we highlighted also is that if we're entering into sales commitments without controlling the upstream, then it places volume risk on the state because we don't have control of having the LNG that will be needed to meet our sales obligations. So our recommendation here was that the state would need to lean on the producers or a third party that has the experience of dealing with these market uncertainties and the experience in the global LNG market to help the state address these risks if an RIK path is to be chosen.
Deepa, Senator French had a question.
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. Counterparty risk. Maybe you could, I feel like I need like a little explanatory paragraph about some of these terms that I'm just not used to working with. Maybe you can just give me a short illustration of what a counterparty is in any given contract and why that risk would fall on me in that situation.
I'd be happy to. Senator French through the chair, but I'm actually going to ask Peter if he wants to speak to that.
Peter Rapp, for the record, Madam Chairman, Senator French through the chair, the counterparty risk that Deepa was referring to there is the party that the state would enter into the long-term sales and purchase agreement with. So, for example, if you had an Asian buyer or a Japanese utility, that would be the counterparty that you would be entering into the contract with. And the counterparty risk that Deepa is referencing would be the credit risk or the performance risk of that party to honor the terms and conditions of the long-term sales and purchase agreement.
Follow-up, Senator French?
I mean, this is probably something I'll just need to have to take offline. I just feel like... And maybe just are you saying that if we promise them gas in a certain volume, we won't be able to make it, or if we promise them at a certain, or if they promise a certain price, that won't come through? I mean, give me just some idea of what that means.
Okay, through the chair, Senator French, what we're referring to with counterparty risk specifically is their ability to perform under the terms of the contract. So, for example, if we delivered the LNG to them as per the terms of the contract, and for whatever reason they were not able to pay for that volume, that would be a risk that the state would assume. So there could be potential bankruptcy risk or credit risk of that counterparty. We would have a provision in the contract where we would have deliver or pay volumes. And again, so if they couldn't physically take the gas for whatever reason, perhaps they didn't have capacity in the regasification terminal to receive the LNG, they'd still have an obligation to pay us. It's possible, perhaps, that they wouldn't pay us for that potential cargo. So we would then have to have the ability to go sell that in the open market to another buyer.
In other words, our customers could experience financial problems or physical interruptions that would hurt us because we were in a contract with them.
Senator French, through the chair, yes, that is correct.
Thank you.
It is always a possibility.
Thank you. Senator Fairclough.
Thank you. And following along, can that be exactly the reverse? If we were not able, as a marketer of the gas, and we had promised to deliver volume, we would be liable in just the opposite way, that we would have to pay damages per se if we were marketing our own gas because we couldn't deliver, and we'd have to find that gas somewhere else so that it could be delivered to where we've promised to deliver it to.
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, yes, that is correct. The state would also assume that risk of non-performance and have to pay liquidated damages in the event that we could not deliver a cargo as we were contracted to do.
Thank you. I don't see – oh, pardon me. Senator French has another question.
Thanks. And just maybe a couple of sentences about negative royalties and maybe just give me an example of where you think the LNG price would be so low that I'd be experiencing negative royalties. I mean, just a ballpark figure. It doesn't even have to be accurate. Just give me something to sort of work with.
For Senator French, through the chair, the midstream tariff on this could be, you know, ballpark about $10 or so. And so if we find ourselves in a world where the global LNG price falls below that level, it could be because we've moved to a natural gas, you know, a Henry Hub type price for the global LNG market. So if we see that happen, if we see a market price that's lower than about $10, we could find ourselves facing negative royalties because the capacity cost that we've committed to is more than the revenue we would get from selling that LNG.
Follow up, Senator French?
Well, just, I mean, you know, when I see negative royalty, it sets off alarm bells. When I guess you could just say state could lose money if the LNG price is too low, and that would set off the same alarm bell. It's just, it's an alarm bell I can understand. Everybody in the room is going up and down like, yep, that's it. Okay, great. Thanks.
Thanks. Go ahead and proceed, Deepa.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On slide 42, to summarize the key findings from the fiscal framework examination was that, you know, Alaska's government take at 70% to 85% is high relative to the other projects that we've looked at, and it's high given the complexity and the size of this project, especially. If we're going to design incentives to help this project be more commercially attractive, then we need to think about designing those incentives in a way that lowers the project cost and to reduce the leakage that we're seeing to the federal government just from a straight reduction in our royalty or taxes. And taking royalty in kind, you know, comes with various risks that we need to be cognizant of and manage prudently on behalf of the state. And the producers definitely have a role to play here in helping the state get comfortable with that.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Deepa, I'm still back on page 41, sort of mulling over the words that were used, that the prices are low, Alaska could lose money. And so I'm wondering, is that true that we would lose money, or is it more a subpar return on an investment after you make it, or a combination of both?
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, it could be a combination of both. If global prices truly fall below our capital commit, you know, our capacity commitments, in an RIK world without equity participation, we could be seeing negative cash flows on an annual basis. And so, you know, that would be a loss of revenue. With equity participation, to answer your question, it would be in the subpar return on our investment.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Deepa. Further questions for Deepa? All right. Deepa, it's now a few minutes past 5 o'clock. We're at a breaking point. Our next topic is risk allocation and commercial structure. So we're going to stop here. The committee has agreed to meet at 8 a.m. tomorrow morning from 8 a.m. to 8:50. So we can take this up at that point. I'm particularly interested, of course, to make sure we go over at some point your supplemental analysis of TransCanada participation, which is an additional slide grouping that you've included here. And whether we get to that tomorrow or on Friday, doesn't matter, but that's an important section. So at this time, I will adjourn the meeting. Our next meeting will be Thursday morning. That's tomorrow at 8 a.m. in this room. And we'll continue on with the presentation. So at this time, meeting is adjourned. The time.